I meant to express my appreciation to the men Sunday who filled in when I wasn't here. I forgot to do it. I'm really grateful that we have men right out of our fellowship that can teach and supply and minister to believers whenever I'm gone or whenever necessary. And it's just a certain confidence I have when I leave. I don't even worry about it. I don't even think about it. I probably don't even pray for them unless on the day I'm thinking about them. I pray for them then, but when I catch myself doing that, then I say I should have been praying more for these guys. But it's somehow I just seem to forget everything when I go away. But I want you to know that inside, I think that's because I have a confidence that they're going to do what they're supposed to do, and that's teach the word. And I'm very, very grateful for that. Now, tonight we have one more chapter that we need to cover before we begin our study of the tabernacle and the instruction for the building of the tabernacle. And this chapter, I think, is going to illustrate for us how very nicely some of the things that we're laying the groundwork for now will tie into the book of Hebrews. In fact, I hope we can go to Hebrews tonight before we're finished. We're on Exodus chapter 24, if you're taking notes. Exodus 24, which I call the inauguration of the Sinaitic Covenant. And the reason I call it that is because there is going to be a ratification. Maybe we should call the ratification would be better. There's going to be a ratification of this Sinaitic Covenant in the chapter. And the book of Hebrews, when it takes up the theme or the contrast or the comparison, it will use a word that means inauguration. And it will refer to this event as the ratification or inauguration of the covenant. Before that happens, there is a command given to Moses in verses 1 and 2 that we need to cover. This is a command to return, to the mountain. It's very difficult in this context to determine how many times Moses had to go up and down that mountain. If I remember right, it was at least five times up to this point, but I wouldn't want to make that categorical because I can't really remember. It seems like it was about five times. But he's down. Oh, no, he's commanded now to do this. And the command reads this way, "And he said unto Moses, come up unto the Lord." I think Moses is already there. And he's going to come down, and he's going to get their covenant ratified, and then he's going to be commanded to come back up. "Come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu." Those, of course, are the two eldest sons of Aaron, which most likely would have succeeded him had they not burnt or offered strange fire in the wilderness experience and had to be wiped out by the Lord. "Bring those two and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off." Now, we're going to see that when we get through the chapter that you have a situation something like this. Here you have the people, multitudes of people. These are supposed to be people. And here you have this mountain. And up here at a certain level, these 70 elders and Aaron are going to go. And then at another level, Joshua is going to go. And then at the top, only Moses is going to go. At this level, we're going to have the Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, 70 elders. We're also going to have Moses and Joshua. Then Moses and Joshua are going to leave, and Joshua will drop off somewhere at another level. We're not told where. And only Moses will go to the top. Okay? Okay. The command, I say command to return to the mountain. He's already up top, I think, when this is going on. there is a key, there are two key words here. The two key words here are worship afar off. Okay? This word worship is a standardized word in the Old Testament. There are about four words, Hebrew words for worship, and this is a standardized word. It is the word shakah. Shakah. And the interesting thing about this word, shakah means to bow down. Okay? To bow down. And the idea in that bowing down is in the concept of adoration, to prostrate oneself. To prostrate oneself in adoration. So it does have the concept of bowing down or lying prostrate on the ground. Now, the interesting thing that I found about this verb is that it is practically always, in fact, I did not find a place in the Old Testament where it was not used in the Hithpael stem. It is used over 80 times in the Hithpael stem in the Old Testament. Now, the Hithpael stem, in the action slots in the Old Testament, in terms of the kind of action in the Old Testament, let's have a grammar lesson right here, okay? Hebrew action in verbs. You have something. You have three kinds of action. You have simple action, you have intensive action, and you have causative action. Now, you can look at the verb, and if you can spot the stem, then they'll fit into one of these slots, see, just by the morphology or the form or the way the word is spelled. Now, in each one of these, to make this a little complex so that Americans would get mental exercise when they studied the language. In each one of these, you have an active voice and you have a passive, or you have an active stem and you have a passive stem. Okay? Okay. So, this Hithpael is a unique one in that it fits down here, and that is reflexive. Okay? There's the action shot. It is intensive action. And it is reflexive, which means yourself is involved. So when the King James translates, and worship afar off, worship ye afar off, the idea is you will bow down, you will bow yourselves down, and you will be, and in the Hithpael stem, that's the reflexive idea, you will bow yourselves down. And then the intensive action, the Hithpael stem, means you will do it with intense vigor in terms of your mentality. See? You're very, very intensely involved in that action. He doesn't use a simple active. You won't be caused to bow down. You will do it yourself, reflexively, and you will do it with a great intensity, a great eagerness. And when you have that word worship in the Old Testament, not every case is it the verb shakah, but when shakah is used, it's predominantly in that Hithpael stem. So I'm sure that that didn't fall on dead ears when he gave that information to Moses, and then Moses had communicated it to the elders of Israel, and to Aaron and Nadab and Abihu. So they were to worship when they came up the mountain, the 70 elders. Now the 70 elders were most likely representative, you see, of the 12 tribes. So here you have Moses, who's going to be the leader, and you have Aaron, who was going to be the high priest. You have Aaron's son, the 70 elders, and Joshua gets thrown in there. He is called Moses' minister, sort of helper, later on in the passage. And they're to go up the mountain, and they're to worship, but you'll notice it is afar off. Okay? So let's pull that word down. Afar off. Okay? Afar off is a indicator that the law did not provide closeness. See? The law did not provide closeness. or relaxed intimacy. With God. Only Jesus Christ could provide that, you see? In other words, only Jesus Christ is going to usher in the graces that gives us a deeper sense of nearness to God and a relaxed intimacy with God. And that will be very, very hard to find under the Old Testament. You'll find only few men rising to that kind of relaxed intimacy with God. I think Moses does, Abraham certainly does, David does, but you don't find it like you have it in general in the New Testament. For example, there's a play on this in Hebrews 10, and I want you to look at that. Look at Hebrews 10 and verse 19. Hebrews 10 and verse 19 through 22. Now he has just finished a great section on the value of the death of Jesus Christ and its significance in terms of removing that which would separate us from God. And so he comes to a conclusion. Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter in... Notice he calls them brothers. He wasn't writing to some who were almost saved or who had made a profession and were about to go back on their... Well, let's put it this way. Who had made a profession but were short of salvation. No, they were brothers. Having therefore, brothers, boldness to enter into the holiness by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart. And I see that word near. In Ephesians, we're told we are made nigh, near to God by the blood of Christ. Let us draw near with a true heart, a full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. And he's making a contrast between those who were separate, even the high priest and even the priesthood in the Old Testament, was separated from the Shekinah glory by the veil that hung in the tabernacle. And only once a year did one person get to go behind that veil, and that was only the high priest. So what we're saying, under the law, it was always afar off. It was always temerity in approach and very dangerous to approach. And only once a year did the high priest get in behind the veil, and that's only one man, where in the new covenant, it's open to all. So this is characteristic of the law. And in the giving of it, God sees to it that he restrains people from rushing to his presence. And even these leaders were commanded that they would worship before all. So verse 2 sort of reinforces it. And Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with him. Okay, so what you have in the passage is you have this command to go up to the mountain with the leaders, and the people are down here in a separated fashion. Then these were to worship somewhere along here, and then Moses was going to go to the top. Now, the thought in the passage is like this. Verse 1 and 2. Moses is up here. This is given to Moses. And he's up here on the top of the mountain, and he's with God. Okay? Then, verse 3 through 8. Yeah, 3 through 8. Here's our mountain again. And here's all the people down here. Blah, blah, blah. Moses is down the mountain, and you're going to have this kind of thing. Okay? And then, in verses 9 through the the last verse in the chapter 18, then you're going to have this command that's given in 1 and 2 fulfilled. See? Elders up to here. Aaron and so on, and Joshua here, and then Moses back up here. Got it? So, in verses 3 through 8, which is the second paragraph now, Moses is down off the mountain, and we have the inauguration, verse 3 through 8, inauguration by blood of the covenant. That sounds like a Pennsylvania Dutchman saying something. It's inauguration of the covenant by blood. Okay? I'm always throwing the horse over the fence some hay. Okay. Now the first thing you have is in verse 3, you have an oral ratification. An oral ratification of God's law. And Moses came and told the people all the words of Jehovah and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Jehovah hath said, we will do. We will perform what Jehovah has asked us to perform. So you had an oral interaction between Moses and the people. However, Moses is alert enough, and perhaps the Lord asked him to do this. I would imagine this was the case. He knows that oral communication breaks down. So in verses 4 through 7, or really it's 4 and 7a, you have written. You now have written ratification of God's law. Okay, verse 4. And Moses wrote all the words of Jehovah and rose up early in the morning, built an altar. Skip that part. He wrote all the words of the Lord. Now skip down to verse 7. And he took the book of the covenant. Okay? So we have written communication, and it is called the book of the covenant. Okay. Now this word that's translated covenant is the word, and we have an article in front of it, so if you write Hebrew, you want to get the article in here. It is the covenant here, this one that's in view, the Sinaitic covenant. Habarith. This is the article. This is the word Berith. Okay? And this is the word the Berith, the covenant. Now, a covenant to a Jew, or in the Old Testament, is always an arrangement. Okay? It always means an arrangement. Or a contract. And just like a contract today, there has to be a mutual agreement. With mutual agreement. Now that's very important when we come to the book of Hebrews. And because it's going to be used that way there too. But the Greeks had a little different twist on the word. So maybe we'll get to see that when we come to the book of Hebrews. Okay? Okay. He writes down, apparently, whether he includes the Ten Commandments, I think he probably did, and then the information that we've had up to this point. And he wrote it all down. It's called the Book of the Covenant. Okay, and God, of course, is going to write the moral law on tables of stone later on and give them to him. Okay, so there's going to be no chance that people won't know what's going on. Or they say, well, we really didn't agree to that. He's going to have a written document. This is what we agreed to, okay? I think that's exciting because here you have a certain amount of information and you have it in documented form, and then you have reference to it all through the Bible so that we're not left to wonder. It's like God saying, here is what it is. This is what I commanded. So that it can't get subjective. It's just like the Word of God, so to speak. They had it in written form. All right. Now, that is going to demand, in turn, a ritual ratification, see, in 4b, verse 4b through 8, excluding these two clauses we have up above, is a ritual ratification. A ritual ratification of God's law. up to this point. Okay? Okay. Verse 4. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill or at the base of the mountain, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto Jehovah. And Moses took half of the... Now, you could imagine what a ceremonial thing this would be, where the pillars would be. He would have the elders of the tribes probably sitting there. Probably a very, very well-organized day when they would sort of dedicate and consecrate and ratify this this covenant. And Moses took half or six of the blood and put it in basins. And half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar, you know, this altar that he had made for this day. And he took the book of the covenant, and he read in the audience of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord hath said we will do, we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood, excuse me, and sprinkled it on the people, and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant." In other words, what he's saying is, behold the official sign of a covenantal agreement ratified by this blood, which the Lord has made with you concerning all these words. Okay? Now, are there any questions up to this point on what happened, what they did? Well, I think he actually walked with that basin, and you know, there's a million and a half to maybe 2 million people there. I don't think he went around and sprinkled everybody. I think he just sort of significantly sprinkled the people with what he had. You know, maybe just a few people. The idea is that this is indicative that this people are attached to this covenant, and this covenant is attached to this people, which is a way of saying this people is attached to Jehovah's law, and Jehovah is attached to this people through his law. Yeah. We're not told. I don't have any idea. We're not told. Probably wasn't, because it's not mentioned. Oh, that's not the people. That's Jehovah. Oh, you mean where the people pass through the... Well, I... No, I don't remember. But it would have to be almost in Deuteronomy. I don't know. That's, I'll say that off the top of my head, because that's where you have a rehash of this in X number of places, but I can't remember. Possibly. Any other questions? Okay. Now, I want to show you how important this is to the book of Hebrews. What you really need to do here in terms of application and how the writer to the Hebrew applies this in terms of significance for us, we need to look at Hebrews chapter 9. Because there is a play on this relative to the new covenant. Okay, so will you look at Hebrews 9? Now, I don't have time to do this whole chapter, and yet this whole thing relates to the whole chapter. So let me simply read a few verses, and then get to the crux of Hebrews 9, where I think you'll see the immediate significance. Chapter 9, verse 1 of Hebrews says, "Then verily, or truly, the first covenant also had ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary, or a sanctuary of this earth." And he's talking, when he says the first covenant, he doesn't mean the first one in time. He is referring to the Sinaitic covenant, because in the book of Hebrews, those are the two covenants he's going to contrast and compare. So he begins to describe some of the intricacies of that first covenant. For there was a tabernacle made, the first, wherein there was a candlestick and the table and the showbread. And this is called the sanctuary. And he's talking about the holy place is called the sanctuary. Then after the second veil in the tabernacle, or the second room in the tabernacle, was called the holiest of all. That's the Holy of Holies. And this is the study that we're coming to in Exodus, see? The study of that building, that sanctuary. Okay? Okay. And then he goes through and describes some of the things of it. Okay? Okay. When he gets down to verse 11, he shifts gears from that sanctuary to Christ. But Christ being come a high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building or this creation, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. And the idea is, Jesus Christ did not go into some earthly building, as good as that earthly building might be, like the tabernacle in the wilderness. But he entered into the very heavenly presence of God, having obtained eternal redemption for us. For if the blood of bulls and of goats and ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifieth to the purifying of the flesh, Old Testament nuances of priestly function, how much more shall the blood of Christ, New Testament, Christ's priestly nuances, who through the eternal covenant spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from serving dead works to serve the living God? For this cause he is the mediator, not of a New Testament. We now shift gears to the word, the Greek word, you see, for covenant, diatheke. Okay? So chapter 9 is going to take up on these two terms, see? The first covenant. Diatheke is the word. Diatheke. D-I-A-T-H-E-K-E. Diatheke is the New Testament equivalent of the Old Testament Berith. Right? That's obvious. Okay? But the problem is that diatheke, to a Greek, could mean a testament or will. All right, when you make a testament or a will, when is it in effect? When you're alive or when you're dead? When does it come into to fruition? When you're dead, not when you're alive. It's effective when you're alive, but it doesn't do anything. It just sits there like a dead document. You know, and when you find out your aunt willed you, you know, $100,000, then you're waiting for her to die the rest of your life. So it'll become effective. So you'll be able to cash in on it. To a Greek, diatheke meant that. See? But you want to remember that Hebrews are writing, Jews are writing the New Testament, and what kind of Greek word are they going to use for berith? Well, they use the word diatheke. It should be translated covenant. For this cause he is the mediator of the new covenant, the new contract between God and man, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant. Why didn't they translate it covenant there? Why did they translate it testament? They supplied the word covenant in the other passage. Well, I don't know. They which are called might receive the promise of inheritance. Now we get into a problem. The next verse. For where a covenant or testament is, there must also of necessity be, King James says, the death of the testator. Now that makes it sound like he is talking about a testament or a will or the Greek concept of covenant. I'd like to give you a better translation of that. 9:16 would better read this way. For where there is a covenant. There is no article with this word. That is a contract, see, an agreement, in the biblical sense of covenant. You always have to stick with that. Biblical sense. And the biblical sense of the word diatheke and bereith, up to this point in the Bible, from Genesis 1:1 up to this point, is always a contract. Always. Okay? So, where there is a covenant, biblical sense, there is of necessity, let's make sure that's, yes, there is of necessity, there is of necessity a death. Okay? Now, the problem of this 16th verse is the translation of the next two words in Greek. There's only two. There's no preposition. And you have to supply it. And the word is in the genitive case, or it could be ablative case. So if you translate it genitively, it would be this way. There is a death of the one who confirms the covenant, or the one who covenants, or there is the death of that which covenants. Or it could be there is a death from the one who covenants. Okay? So it would be this way. Here are the two possibilities. There is a death, if you interpret ablative case, from the one who covenants. Or, in other words, this, if you interpret it that way, then the one who covenants has to provide some blood or a death to ratify the covenants, would be the idea. The other possibility is there is a death of that which covenants. You could say there is the death of the covenantor. I guess you could say that too, another possibility, of the covenantor, the one who makes the covenant. But now go back to the Old Testament. Go back to the Sinaitic law. Go back to Exodus 24. When they ratified the covenant, did anybody who made the covenant die? Did God die? No. Did Moses die? No. Did Aaron or any of the people of Israel die? No. But that which ratified the covenant had to die. Some innocent animals had to die, and they had to catch the blood. And then the blood ratified the covenant. To show you that's where he's taking us, look at verse 19. For when Moses had spoken every precept, verse 18, whereupon neither the first covenant was dedicated, or that's our word inaugurated. That is where we got that word inauguration. For neither the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and of goats with water. Oh, here we are, hyssop. Yeah. And scarlet wool and hyssop. Gee, I read this 10 times last week. And sprinkled both the book and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the new covenant, or this is the blood of the covenant which God hath enjoined unto you. See what I'm saying? So in the case of Moses, which he is arguing from, you with me? In the case of Moses, which he is arguing from, this passage would have to read something like this. For where there is a covenant, in the biblical sense, there is of necessity a death, either from the one who covenants, or of that which covenants, or of that which seals the covenant, see? Okay? Well, how would we translate 9:17? Now we have another problem. These are two hard verses, and you'll find a lot of debate on these verses. This is similar to reading the instructions for your income tax. It's a little hard to figure out in the Greek New Testament. You know, I had a Class B miracle happen yesterday. You know? I was doing my final form on my income tax. Now, my income tax is not simple. It's not overly complex, I guess. I do Schedule A and B and C and D and Schedule S, E, I do a business statement, just as a matter that I've always done. I show all my income and I show all my expenses on. I do a library depreciation fee with a figure in for my office in my home, which is a 10-year straight line depreciation, and it's about that long now. This year I had to fill out Form 2119. I had to do 3468 form. Okay. So what I'm trying to communicate to you is, it's not the simplest. There's a lot of numbers on these pages, okay? Now, because I am self-employed relative to Social Security and paying that way, I pay quarterly estimated taxes, right? In other words, I sent my estimated tax in for 1980, the first quarterly payment. And you send them in quarterly, see if you're self-employed. Now, I'm doing this final form on my income tax. And I find a place where I made a mistake and I correct it and everything. Anyhow, boom, boom, I get it all done and I come down to my estimated tax that I paid last year in four payments and the real tax, and they are precisely the same. And I said to my wife, I ran downstairs, I said, they'll never believe it. I'll get audited for sure. I don't even believe this myself. This is impossible. So I wrote them a note, and I said, I don't believe it. Check it over close. I must have made a mistake. This is incredible. This is a miracle. At least it's a first time for me. Did you ever have that happen, Roland? Huh? Now, there's a guy who has a business, a CPA, and his own business, and been doing this for, see, it's never had, it's a miracle. It's a Class B miracle. Doesn't have anything to do with Diatseke, but it's on my mind. Okay, it's off my mind now. Okay, let's read the next verse because it throws a kink into this. It makes this a little more difficult. Verse 17 in King James says, For a covenant is, and you don't have to supply the verb is a force after men are dead. That's not true of a covenant. A covenant is of force while men are alive. A testament is of force after men are dead, right? A testament is a will. Is he shifting gears? Is he now using the word like a Greek? No. Here is what he says. Listen to what I'm saying now. It isn't after death. There is no word after. Translation should be like this. The preposition is upon death, for a covenant, not F-O-R-E, that's what you yell on the golf course, for a covenant, and you supply the verb is established, or, that's it. Established is the right word, that's right, is established, upon, no article, a death. See, the proof that that is the correct translation of that are the next few verses. Because when they established the first covenant, something had to die. And then he's going to go all the way and say, for without the shedding of blood, there is no remission, see? Okay, so a covenant is established upon a death. That's really super up to that point. Since it never, now we have a negating idea, it never has strength or force. It never has force. The verb is eskuo, it means strength. When, and now we have the problem because we have this same little noun that we had up here. I'm not sure if it's a noun or a participle. It's a substantive. It's definitely a substantive. And the difficulty is in interpreting it. It never has strength. Well, that which confirms it lives, that would be taking this interpretation. See? And I'm going to put a question here because we have difficulty. Here's the hard part. When that which confirms it lives. And I'm taking liberties with the word when I translate it that way. See what I'm saying? Because you could translate it like the New American Standard. Would somebody read the New American Standard on verse 9:17 and listen to the last couple words? quickly. Somebody read that. Anybody? Yeah, that's definitely a testament. That's definitely means the New American Standard Version. Take that New American Standard Version translator, take that word and interpret it as a testament or a will. Which means that they have to run contrary to every time the word is used in the rest of the Bible. They have to do that to interpret it that way. But with the death of Jesus Christ, it's a possibility. See? That's the unique twist in it. Okay? That's the unique twist. Because involved in the establishment of the new covenant is the eternal covenant. And the eternal covenant is an agreement between the Father and the Son that the Son would become human and shed his blood for the sins of mankind. So it's a possibility that in this one place we could say when the covenantor, when the covenantor, this is a possible translation, is alive. In which case it would be limited to Jesus Christ. Now, is that blown by you, or do you see what I'm trying to say? It's awful hot in here, but you are awake. What I'm saying is there's two possible... This translation that I'm giving you here takes liberty with the words, but this is consistent with the context, or consistent with the context and biblical usage of covenant. Okay? This translation down here doesn't take liberty with the word. But it's a little bit hard in the context because the word covenant is never used like testament in the Bible except in this one place, if that's the case. We do not have a New Testament. We have a new covenant. There never was an Old Testament. There was only an old covenant. See what I'm saying? An old contract. Now what makes it look like this is the proper, the one that I'm suggesting is the proper interpretation is the next few verses. Whereupon, neither the first covenant was dedicated or inaugurated without blood. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet hyssop and wool, sprinkled upon the book, and all the people saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God hath enjoined to you." Moreover, and then this is a later incident than Exodus 24. This is Exodus 29, I think. He sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And then the writer to the Hebrews adds, and almost all things are by the law purged with blood. The reason he says not almost, the reason he doesn't say all things is because there are some exceptions. There were some washings, there were some purgings by fire, and so on. But almost all things are purged by blood. Without the shedding of blood is no remission. It was therefore necessary that the patterns or the types of things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things with better sacrifices than these. For Christ does not enter into holy places made with hands, which are figures of the true, but into article the heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Fantastic chapter. I'd like to go over all the steps of logic in that, but I don't have time. I'm just simply taking you to that to show you how New Testament writers will build upon Old Testament truth. Or, could we say, they will not just simply build upon it. They will compare and contrast. They will show likenesses and differences in order to bring out the significance of New Testament truth and the significance of Old Testament truth. Any questions up to this point? I hope that didn't thoroughly confuse you. All right, let's go back to Exodus and finish that beautiful instruction to Moses. The last thing that happens in this chapter, verses 9 through 18, is that God reveals himself. God reveals himself to a few. Verse 9 through 18. Then went up Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and several, and the 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel. The word for God is Elohim with an article. And they saw Elohim, promorphism, that God now appears as though he has feet. There was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone. And as it were, the body of heaven in clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he laid not his hand. In other words, they didn't touch. Also they sought God and did eat and drink, which is an intimation of fellowship. See, intimate fellowship. Now there's two different words for saw here. They saw God. And it's mentioned twice. In verse 10, you have a normal word for see, which is simply the word, it's just simply a cal imperfect of ra'av. This is ra'ah, not ra'av. Okay, this is ra'ah. Now, this is just the normal verb to see. It has to do, in its normal usage in the Old Testament, it is an act of the senses to see or to look in the general sense, an act of the senses. But in verse 11, they saw is a different word. And it's, again, just simply a cal stem of Kazah. This word takes the concept of seeing and looking and applies it to the mentality. So this has the idea to see and perceive. It's a stronger word, in other words. And it has the idea that they saw him with their senses, but they saw more than that. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he laid not his hands. Also they saw or perceived God. Then you have the concept. See, it is after this, and they ate and drank. See what I'm saying? The idea here is fellowship. This did not produce fellowship, seeing with the senses, but seeing and perceiving is followed by fellowship. Okay? Okay. Now, what did they see? Okay? What did they see? Okay? Now, the answer to that question is that has to be governed. This has to be governed. When any time in the Old Testament, I don't care, any time in the Bible, I care where you are, when someone is said to have seen God, it has to be governed by other statements of God. And in this case, it has to be governed by Exodus chapter 33. Would you look at that? This is governed by Exodus 33, verse 20 through 23. Exodus 33, verse 20. Now, this is Moses. Okay, very shortly near to when the journey is going to resume. he's having trouble, and he appeals to Jehovah. And Moses in verse 18 says, "I beseech you, Lord, show me your glory." And Jehovah said, "I will make all my goodness pass before you. I will proclaim the name of Jehovah before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy." And he said, "But you cannot see my face, for there shall no man see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me. Thou shalt stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, when my glory passes by, that I will put you in a cleft in the rock, and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away my hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen." Now, what did Moses see? Okay? Well, I think we have to say that when the Lord uses the word face, he means that all of his essence and all of his resplendent glory, man cannot see it in his sinful state and live. Something has to be changed in man for that to happen. So he says, "No man can see me and live." So, whatever they saw over here, they really didn't see God in all of his glory. That can't happen and a man live. They most likely saw a Christophany, as did Moses. Most likely a Christophany, an appearance of Christ before the incarnation. And when they see that, they see some type of a physical presence. A physical presence of God, so that the description can be made in physical terms. Moses saw his feet. Moses saw his hinder parts. But Moses did not see his face. Now, that type of a manifestation, then, would make the incarnation a little more easy to accept if you really believe this, that God would appear in physical form. The hard thing about the incarnation is that when he appeared in physical form, it wasn't as a full-grown, full-bodied man, it was as a baby. Remember that? Okay, they did see a manifestation of God. They did perceive that it was God. Okay, most likely a Christophany. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's not too bad. That's not too bad. In other words, I don't know if they mean by the passage that there was like a roadway going up toward the heaven, but I think the idea more is the idea of clarity, of radiance, with no cloudiness, with, say, no Shekinah glory cloudy to make it mystic. It was more the idea of clearness and brilliance. Okay? Well, it most likely wasn't the full glory. Not the full glory of Jehovah Elohim, but the radiance of the essential essence of Christ. It wasn't really the full Shekinah glory, so to speak. Couldn't they, see, because of that passage in Exodus 33. Something has to be changed in us before we can live in the very presence of the splendor of God. Yeah, oh yeah, of course, yeah. Okay? Okay, so there they are. And they're having a good time. And the Lord says to Moses, "Okay, Moses, it's time to come up top." So they're somewhere up on the mountain, and then Moses is going to go farther. "Come up to the top and be there, and I will give you tables of stone and a law and commandments which I have written, that thou may teach them. And Moses rose up and his minister Joshua. And Moses went up to the mount of God, and he said unto the elders, tarry you here for us. And he's going to leave Aaron and the others behind. And so the us must mean Moses and Joshua. Behold, and we will come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, talk to them. So Moses went up into the mountain. Joshua probably went a little bit farther with him. And then he was left off, and then Moses went to the top. And Moses went up into the mount, and the cloud covered the mount. And the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai. And the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire on top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. And when he rehearses the story in Deuteronomy 9:9, he said he didn't have anything to eat and he didn't have any water during that time. He may have had something else to drink, but he didn't have any water, according to that passage in Hebrews. So, what you have, then, up to this point, is you have the moral law given, you have the civil law, which reinforces the moral law, makes it more specific, you have it written down in a book of a covenant, you have it ratified, and now you have Moses back in Mount, and you're going to have complete instructions for the plans and the details of the tabernacle in the wilderness, and we'll take up prayer next time. Any questions we could try to answer? Tim? Yeah. Yeah. A Christophany would be the Son making himself manifest, or God, the Son, coming to man. A theophany would just be appearance of deity, simple appearance of deity, without making a distinction within the Godhead. Well, what he means is a theophany appearing in the form of physical. Isn't that what you mean?
I'm asking you.
Well, what do you mean when you
say a theophany?
I'm trying to think of an illustration, perhaps, of one.
When Job says that God speaks to Job out of the book, and then at the conclusion of all that, Job says, now I have my eye to see you, is that a theophany?
Well, I think you'd have to say, yes, that was a theophany. The Jacob passage. Not sure. I'd have to look and see. I'd have to look at the details to see, to try to give you a contrast before I'd want to commit and say, this is one, this is another. I'd have to look. I think that it might be almost in general we could say that a physical appearance most likely would be a Christophany, but I don't know that holds true in every case. One would have to look at the case and guess and weigh it.
Scofield provides their interpretation of the theophany as a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ.
They make it the same then as a Christophany.
Yeah, in a sense, but they maintain a difference by saying it's pre-incarnation and post-incarnation.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because you're using the word Messiah. Yeah. Okay. That might be pretty good. Any other questions? Okay, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for the assurance of your communication to mankind. We're not left to wonder when we have such specific passages as these on the Old Covenant. Pray that as we identify with these truths that you'll give us opportunity to give expression to this to others. We're particularly grateful for Jewish contacts that we have and that we can communicate to them about the meaningfulness and the richness of your communication to Israel through Moses and the experiences at Sinai. So we thank you and we pray for greater opportunity to give expression of our understanding and identity with this in Christ's name. Amen.